we have been going through a prophetic timeline of the future. The prophetic timeline started in chapter 1, and chronologically, each vision is an extension giving us more information. Each vision gives us more information in a chronological timeline. And so we are able to see the unfolding of what God has planned for the future. In our last study, what we saw was that evil and wickedness will eventually show up in Shinar. The vision was about a woman who was in a basket that was 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot, and two evil women who had wings of a stork took the basket, took it to Shinar, and were told that the woman who was in the basket was wickedness, and the basket was wicked, so everything about it is wicked. The woman in the basket's wicked, the basket's wicked, the carriers of the basket are wicked. Everything that's wicked goes to Shinar, and that's where it's dropped, and it's in a temple, implying worship. And so the whole picture of the last vision was about evil going to Shinar. And if you recall, Shinar is an Old Testament term that refers to a region that we call Babylonia, or where the Babylonian Empire originated. And to be more specific, is that the capital of it was actually the city of Babylon. And so when we are told that evil was taken to Shinar, what we're to understand is that the headquarters is Babylon. And the region is down in what we call the Mesopotamia area, where the Tigris River and the Euphrates River flow through. That was the message of the last vision. Our vision tonight is going to show us how God's going to deal with the evil when it blossoms, if I can put it that way, in the land of Shinar. In Revelation chapter 18, verse 2, we were told, "And he cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great.'" Now, this Babylon that's being referred to has symbolic meaning, but I believe it also is a geographic area. It's actually the city of Babylon, and that is mentioned here in Revelation. And it says, "She has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird." So what Revelation is telling us is that the city of Babylon will be a place where the demons will gather. Now, if you go back to Revelation chapter 9, verse 1, you'll see a very interesting statement, very important statement. By the way, this all dovetails together. Revelation 19:1 says, "And then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him." So here's an angel, and the angel is given a key, and we're told, "And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke came up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. And then out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth, and power was given to them as scorpions of the earth have power. And they were told not to hurt the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only the men who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads." And I believe that what's being described, if you continue reading, are really demons. Because if you skip all the way down to verse 10, it says, "And they have tails like scorpions and stings, and in their tails is their power to hurt men for 5 months. They have a king over them, the angel of the abyss." Now catch the key statement, angel. And that's their leader. And his name in Hebrew is Abaddon. You can check that out in Proverbs chapter 27, verse 20. And in the Greek, his name is Apollyon. And this, I believe, is Satan. What's actually being described is what comes out of this bottomless pit or this abyss. Angels that are coming out, they're demons. When I say angels, you say, how does demons and angels connect? Well, actually, demons are angels. Demons are angels. Demons are fallen angels or evil angels or wicked angels. We also call them spirits. That's important to remember. We also hear that they're unclean spirits. There are also evil spirits. There's lots of different terminology used for fallen angels. And I believe that these are especially evil angels. In other words, there's two classes of demons. There are normal demons. So I don't know what that means. But then there are also angels who were in disobedience, and they were actually assigned to the abyss, the bottomless pit. And I believe that's what's being described here. That is that there are demons who already have access to the world. They can move about. There are demons or fallen angels who are assigned to a bottomless pit. They're locked up. We're told that in 1 Peter and Jude. And Jesus actually refers to that in the Gospels. Remember, there was a man who was demon-possessed, and there was a legion. They say, we're a legion. That is, there were a lot of us. And they pleaded with Jesus not to be sent to the abyss. If you recall, and I believe that's what is being referred to here and was referred to in 1 Peter and Jude, that is that there is a special class of angels because of disobedience have been assigned to abyss, and they're not free to roam about on the earth. I believe that's what's being released here in chapter 9. So watch this. This is in the region called Shinar. You say, how do you know that? Keep reading. The same chapter, look at verse 13. And then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, one saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. I believe that in the last vision, when it says that the evil goes to the land of Shinar, I believe what we're supposed to understand is, yes, evil goes there. The demons go there, Satan goes there, and at the end of the tribulation, there's going to be just a massive number of demons, including Satan, in the land of Shinar in Babylon. It's the headquarters of the one world government. The Antichrist is in control. The false prophet's in control. I mean, it is one incredibly evil and wicked place to be. That was the end of our last study. And our study tonight picks it up from there. So let's go to Zechariah now. And let me read the last verse of chapter 5. That's the end of the last vision. And it says, and then he said to me to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar. The her is the woman in the basket who is called wickedness in verse 8. And we're told in when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal. And we pointed out last time that probably the best translation of the Hebrew is that once the temple is built, she's put there. She's put there. And this is false worship, demonic worship. And the demonic worship is going to be the Antichrist. Remember what happens in Revelation 13? The Antichrist declares that he is God, and the religious leader directs all worship to the Antichrist, if you recall. And if you don't worship the Antichrist, you end up dying. I mean, that's the penalty. So this all fits. So Zechariah chapter 6, verse 1 says, now I lifted up my eyes again, and behold, four chariots were coming forth from between the two mountains. Now notice it says the two mountains. This isn't just any random two mountains. This is the two mountains, and the mountains were bronze mountains. Now, we're given some symbology here. It's important to realize what's going on. We have four chariots and two mountains. That's the symbology of this vision. So we're going to talk about the four chariots. We'll talk about the four chariots more in verses 2 and 3. So what I'm going to focus in on is about two mountains. And the two mountains, we're told, are the two mountains. And I think what we're supposed to understand, in fact, most conservative commentators believe that the two mountains are Mount Zion and the Mount of Olives. Mount Zion is where the temple resided, and the Mount of Olives was east of Jerusalem, or east of Zion, or east of Jerusalem. The more problematic statement is the last part of the verse. The last part of the verse says, and the mountains were bronze mountains. And the question is, what does it mean, bronze mountains? Many commentators say that what this is referring to is judgment. So the mountains are symbolic of judgment. Well, I have a problem with that view. Let me show you why. I did a survey of the use of bronze in the Old Testament. If you were to look at the vast number of places that the word bronze shows up, and you were to see how it's used, most of the time it's used in conjunction with the building components of the tabernacle. Almost all of the time that the word bronze shows up, it's about a ring or it's about something that's going to be part of the building or the construction of the tabernacle. And so that would seem to me to suggest holiness. Check out Exodus chapters 26 through 39. In Numbers chapter 31 and 27, in Exodus chapter 27, verse 2, you find that bronze is used of the bronze altar and also of the bronze serpent that Moses held up after the Israelites sinned, and if they were to look on it, they were spared. I believe that that speaks of judgment, so I am in agreement with the commentators who believe that the bronze is symbolic of judgment because the bronze altar dealt with sin, so that would be consistent. But it's also interesting to note that bronze is also used in military armor. In fact, when it is referred to, it's referred to giving strength. So bronze was also a symbol of strength. And bronze also is symbolic of protection. Protection of walls in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 18, chapter 15, verse 20. By the way, I failed to mention that the passage related to strength for military armor is Judges 16, 21. So you put it all together, I think that bronze has multiple meanings. That is that it can mean holiness, it can mean judgment, it can mean strength, it can be symbolic of protection. And isn't that what God does? God's symbolic of all of that. God is holy. He judges those who aren't holy. He provides strength and he provides protection. And I believe that's exactly what these mountains are. Mount Zion and the Mount of Olives are symbolic of God's holiness because you're going to find out when we get to Zechariah chapter 14 that the Mount of Olives is where Jesus comes and descends. And we're going to find out that Mount Zion is where God dwells. Holy God with a holy millennial kingdom. So symbolic of holiness. Also, if you come against God's mountains, you're going to get judged. And he's going to protect his mountains, and you're not going to defeat him, so I think it's symbolic also of strength and protection. The two mountains, while they are maybe curiosity points for us, the real message is in the chariots, verse 2. Verse 2, we read, with the first chariot were red horses, and with the second chariot, black horses, and with the third chariot, white horses, and with a fourth chariot, strong, dappled horses. So what we see here in these two verses are four chariots, and we're told explicitly there are horses connected with these chariots. And the question is, what does it mean that we have red horses and black horses and white horses and dappled horses? Well, if you go to Zechariah chapter 1, verse 8, which I won't do, you'd find out that we had horses introduced there. We had red horses, we had white horses, we had sorrel horses. We had no black horses, though, in chapter 1. So it appears that in this prophecy, black horses are added. Now, it's really interesting that this section, chapters 1 through 6, which is a unit, Zechariah, we are told, is given to vision, and it turns out that within this vision are a series of visions, in fact, 8 little visions within this vision, from chapters 1 to 6, and at the very beginning, he starts off with horses, and at the very end, he ends with horses. It's like bookends on a bookcase. Horses in the front, horses in the back, and here we have four chariots with four sets of horses. Go to Revelation. I want to explain what we believe these horses are symbolic of. These horses symbolize something. In Revelation chapter 6, gives us a pretty good explanation of what these horses are symbolic of. Verse 1, then I saw the Lamb broke one of the seven seals and heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, come. And I looked, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Now, this white horse, I believe, symbolizes peace and also a victory. It's symbolic of both. I mean, when you get victory, you get peace. And you say, how do you figure that one out? Well, keep reading verse 3. And when he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, come. And another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it was granted to take peace from the earth. So the first horse is a white horse, and the second horse takes peace away. So what does that mean the first horse is symbolic of? Peace. So the second horse is not symbolic of peace. In fact, it's symbolic of war and blood, and it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men should slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. So we have two horses now. White horse symbolizes victory, symbolizes peace. The second horse, the red horse, symbolizes war or blood. Then if you go to verse 5, we find, and he broke the third seal, and I heard the third living creature saying, come, and I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine. You say, what's being described? Famine. The black horse symbolizes famine. That's why you have scales. And the prices are astronomical compared to what they should be. So the message is that there's famine in the land, and in order to buy anything, cost you an arm and a leg. Whoever can pay the most gets it. Verse 7, and when the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come. And I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, tridapple, trisorrel. I believe they're all interchangeable concepts. And he who sat on it had the name of death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine, with pestilence, and by the wild beasts of the earth. So there are four horses. White is what? Symbolic of victory and peace. Black horses are symbolic of famine. Red horses are symbolic of killing or blood or war. And the dapple horses are symbolic of death. So we have four chariots. Each chariot is pulling a set of horses. The horses are given colors. And we are to understand that these represent different aspects of death and suffering. So verse 4, and then I spoke and said to the angel who was speaking with me, what are these, my Lord? That's a good question. Verse 5, the angel replied to me, these are the four spirits of heaven going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth. Now, I believe that the four spirits of heaven here are actually four angels. And there are two reasons for that. First of all, if you were to check out Matthew chapter 24, verse 31, we read this, and he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. So I believe that the reference to four is referring to total inclusion, the reference to the idea that every part, every aspect of the earth. In Revelation chapter 7, verse 1, it says, and after this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind would blow on the earth and on the sea or on any tree. And I believe that with references to four, the four winds, the four corners, is just referring to completeness. And the second reason I believe these are angels is that the Hebrew word itself means wind or spirits. Now, what did we point out earlier? What are demons? Demons are angels. In Scripture, especially in the Gospels, they're referred to as spirits, evil spirits. The angels actually are wicked angels or evil angels. Here in this passage, it says, for spirits, these spirits are angels. And then there's a third reason why I believe that these are angels. So when it says standing before the Lord of the earth, if you were to check out 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 9, and Daniel 7, verse 10, you find out that angels are standing in the presence of the Lord. Now, it's important to notice that these four spirits are standing before the Lord of all the earth. And so I believe that these are angels. So what does it mean? You have four chariots pulled by different kinds of horses, and now we're told in verse 5 that they're really angels. Verse 6, and with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white ones go after them, while the dapple ones go forth to the south country. So now we're told in verse 6 something really interesting and worth noting. We're told that the black horses go north, the white horses go after them, and we're told that the dappled horses go south. Now, I don't know if bells are going off in your mind. You say, why? Later this week, read Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. Guess what comes against Israel in those two chapters? Nations from the north come down against Israel at the end of the tribulation period, at Armageddon. Remember, Armageddon occurs at the end of the tribulation period? And so what are these horses doing? They're going against the armies that are coming down from the north. And what horses are going up? The black horses. What are they about? Famine. The white horses follow with victory and peace, right? So it implies battle. And the dappled horses are death. And where are they going? They're going south. But in Daniel chapter 11, verses 41 to 43, actually starts with verse 40, goes to verse 45, there is a battle described. And it's the Battle of Armageddon, battle at the end of the tribulation period. And what we're told is that the Antichrist will actually come from Babylon, comes into the beautiful city, which is Jerusalem. And then we're told in verses 41 to 43, he enters into a battle with the north. He then comes down and enters into Egypt to defeat Egypt. In verses 44 to 45, he hears rumors of armies coming down from the north and from the east. And he goes out to meet them, to do battle. And I believe that that's what's being described here in this passage, that the horses are going up to the north against the invading army. And we're also told that he goes south. That's what's being described at the end of Daniel chapter 11. And I want you to think about something for a second. The horses go north and the horses go south. Where are we told the horses don't go? We're not told that they go east, and we're not told they go west. And why would the horses not go west? Well, one reason they wouldn't go west is because the Mediterranean Sea is in the west. And why don't they go east? Well, they don't go east because, one, Daniel chapter 11 tells us that they don't go east. In fact, who's east? Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And we're told explicitly in Daniel chapter 11, listen to what it says. It says, and he will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Now, where was Moab and Edom and Ammon? Well, they occupied what's currently referred to as Jordan and Saudi Arabia. We're explicitly told in Daniel that those regions will be protected. And so in Zechariah chapter 6, we're told they go north and south, but they don't go east. And there's no reason to go west. That's the sea, Mediterranean Sea. And this is an incredible prophecy here in Zechariah chapter 6, verse 6. Verse 7 says, and then the strong ones went out, and they were eager to go to patrol the earth, And he said, go patrol the earth. So they patrolled the earth. So in verse 7, we're told the strong ones went out, and they were eager to go and to patrol the earth. So once they got through going south, and they went off and did something else, we are not told what they did. Now, there's something very curious about this passage of Scripture. We're never told what the red horses did. There is no explanation about the red horses. What did the red horses do? The red horses are symbolic of war and blood. What did they do? We are not told, so I can't tell you. I'll speculate, okay? This is my opinion, my view. I have no scriptural support for it, but it's my view that when the strong ones went out, I think the red horses went too. I think we're supposed to understand that. And now the question is, what did they do? I find it interesting that we're told that they patrolled the entire earth. I mean, the Battle of Armageddon isn't the entire earth. In fact, we're told in the Minor Prophets and in the Major Prophets that God gathers them together, all the nations of the world, to an area that we refer to as the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Some people call it Megiddo, where the Battle of Armageddon occurs. So the Battle of Armageddon doesn't occur around the world. You with me? So why are they going out around the world? Here's my opinion. And these are angels, by the way. The angels are going out, and they are removing all of the non-Christians around the globe. We call it the goat and sheep judgment. And remember who gets to go into the millennial kingdom? Only Christians. And I believe what verse 7 is talking about is very cryptic. The Hebrew is very difficult to understand. So I'm really off on a limb here, but I'm giving you my opinion. I believe that what's happening in verse 7 is the goat and sheep judgment, and the dappled horses and the red horses are going off because the major battle is coming from the north. Point. They already took care of Egypt, and in Daniel chapter 11, when you read the entire chapter, it talks about the kings of the north, kings of the south, and that's exactly what's being described here, are battles north and south. Okay, verse 8. Verse 8 is the end of our study for the night. Verse 8 says, and he cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, see, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north. Now, this is the whole reason for the vision. And that is that God the Father's wrath has finally been appeased. Evil went to the land of Shinar, right? That's where the demons are. That's where Satan is, right? And what happens at Armageddon? Jesus Christ comes on a horse with a sword, and what does he do? He destroys the armies of the world. He takes Satan. He throws him in the abyss. The false prophet and the Antichrist are thrown into the lake of fire. What happens? Evil is crushed in the land of Shinar. This vision picks up where the last vision left off. In the last vision, we were told that evil goes to the land of Shinar. Here in chapter 6, verse 8, we're told, finally, the wrath of the Father has been appeased. And then the millennial kingdom sets up. You say, like, how do you know the millennial kingdom's next? Next study. The reason these prophecies are exciting to us and important to us is because we have a God that's faithful. And so when we read them, we say, it's going to happen. There's another response. Why do you think God wrote these for the Israelites? I think the reason that God wrote these is you're going to see that God's trying to encourage the Israelites. And if God's trying to encourage the Israelites by telling them what's going to happen in the future, what does that mean that God assumes that they are going to do? Believe Him. You know what prophecy is about? Prophecy is not just about getting to see what the future is. The only reason prophecy means anything to us is that we believe Him. Trust Him. Prophecy is not just seeing the future, but prophecy means that I have a God that I trust. I trust that you trust Him, because then this has real meaning to you if you trust Him. These prophecies are also written for our encouragement. We see that God's going to deal with evil. He's going to squash it. Let's pray.